Joyce. We won't tell anyone. I write poetry.
I don't have time for poetry, says Elizabeth. Never have, never will. Do you mind if we get on to Ryan Baird?
Oh, yes, says Poppy, and reaches over the side of her chair for her bag. She pulls out a file and hands it to Elizabeth.
Name, address, email, mobile number, and recent call log, national insurance, NHS records, browser history, mobile numbers of close associates. I'm afraid that's all I could get at short notice.
That will do for starters. Thank you, Poppy, says Elizabeth.
Don't thank me, says Poppy. Thank Douglas. If it was up to me, you wouldn't have them. I'm sorry to say it doesn't feel entirely legal.
Oh, nothing's legal anymore. You can barely walk down the street these days. You have to bend the rules sometimes, says Elizabeth.
But that's just it, isn't it? Says Poppy. I don't want to bend the rules. It doesn't give me a thrill. It gives you a thrill, doesn't it?
Yes, agrees Elizabeth.
Well, not me. It makes me anxious. And my whole job is bending rules.
I'd be the same, says Joyce.
Oh, Joyce, get over yourself, says Elizabeth. You would have made the perfect spy.
I still think Poppy should do her poetry.
Thank you, says Poppy. That's what my mum says, too, and she's usually right.
Don't get me wrong, I think you should too, says Elizabeth.
I don't want to hear it, but you should certainly do it.
First, though, we have this job to do, to protect Douglas.
I can't wait to meet him, says Joyce.
Are you worried I'll fall in love with him? Joyce, you will find him very handsome, but you will see through him in a moment.
We'll see, says Joyce. Poppy, can I ask why you have a tattoo of a daisy on your wrist? I would have thought you'd have a tattoo of a poppy.
Poppy smiles and strokes the small tattoo.
Daisy is my grandmother. I told her once I wanted a tattoo, and she said over her dead body, anchors and mermaids and so on. So I went away, had this done, and showed it to her the next time I visited. I said, Daisy, meet Daisy. And there wasn't a lot she could say about it then, was there?
Clever girl, says Joyce.
Then 2 weeks later, I went round again and she rolled up her sleeve and said, Poppy, meet Poppy. A great big poppy tattoo all the way up her forearm. She said if I was going to be an idiot, then she was too.
Elizabeth laughs and Joyce claps her hands.
Well, she sounds just our type, says Elizabeth.
Poppy, if this is your last job with the service, so be it, but I promise we'll do everything we can to make it a fun one for you.
We will, says Joyce.
Another macaroon, Poppy? You enjoyed the last one.
Poppy raises a hand to decline the offer.
We won't let anyone in here who shouldn't be here. Douglas will be quite safe, which of course means you will be quite safe too, says Elizabeth.
Unless they show up this evening while we're eating macaroons, says Poppy.
And while we all sit around with nothing to do, I'm sure we can crack the mystery of what Douglas has done with the diamonds.
Well, he denies stealing them, as you know, and besides, that's not our job, says Poppy. Our job is to protect Douglas.
Poppy, I honestly don't mind you being anxious. I don't mind you being conflicted. I don't even mind you being arty, but I absolutely won't tolerate you being boring, because I can tell you are not a boring human being. Do we have a deal?
Don't be boring.
If it's not too much to ask.
You both really think I should write poetry?
Oh, yes, says Joyce.
What's that poem I like?
Poppy and Elizabeth look at each other. They don't know.
While she is looking at Elizabeth, Poppy says, "In the interest of not being boring, can I ask you a question?"
"Up to a point, yes," says Elizabeth.
"How did you end up in the service? Did you follow your dream?"
"And I need the non-boring answer, please. I'm not a tourist."
Elizabeth nods.
"I had a professor. I was studying French and Italian at Edinburgh. Anyway, he had friends who were always on the lookout, and he floated the idea, and it wasn't for me. But then he'd float it again and again."
"And why did you finally sign up?"
"Well, he was desperate to sleep with me, this professor. People were in those days. So I knew he wanted to sleep with me, and I knew he wanted me to interview for the service. And I honestly felt I should probably do one or the other. You know how men can be with rejection. So I had to either sleep with him or interview with the service, and I chose the lesser of two evils. And once the service has its hooks in you, they don't like to let go, as you'll find out."
"So your career was just to avoid sleeping with someone?" asks Poppy.
Elizabeth nods.
"What do you think you would have done otherwise?"
"I know you don't like to keep secrets, Poppy, but you have been very helpful with Ryan Baird. So here's something I don't think I've ever told anyone before. Not my family, none of my husbands, not even Joyce. I always fancied being a marine biologist."
Poppy nods.
"Marine biologist?" says Joyce. "What is that? Dolphins and so on?"
Elizabeth nods. Joyce reaches over and places her hand on her friend's arm.
"I think you would have made a wonderful marine biologist."
Elizabeth nods again.
"Thank you, Joyce. I might have, mightn't I?"
Chapter 15. Douglas Middlemiss is in bed reading a book about Nazis, largely anti, when he hears the noise. It is the door to the flat opening very slowly and very quietly. It isn't Poppy, she came back an hour or so ago. Where had she been? Collared by Elizabeth, perhaps? That would be Elizabeth's style, killing the new girl with kindness. Speaking of killing, the door being opened quite so softly is bad news for Douglas. Only he and Poppy have keys, and the only other way to open a door that quietly is to be a professional. So what was this? A burglar or an assassin? He would find out soon enough. Douglas wishes he had a gun. In the old days, he would have done. Once, in Jakarta, he accidentally shot a cultural attaché from the Japanese embassy through the arm during a bout of vigorous lovemaking. She was terrifically good about it. The National Gallery was persuaded to lend a Rembrandt to a Tokyo museum, and nothing more was said about it. But from that day on, he would tape his gun under the bed rather than leave it under the pillow. He thought all this as he took off his reading glasses, did up the button fly on his pyjama bottoms, and slipped out of bed. Poppy had a gun. She didn't seem the type to ever use it, but she must have had the training, surely. Had she heard the front door open? Perhaps not. Douglas had grown alert to danger over the years, but Poppy would not have, perhaps never would. He'd met Poppy's type many times before, and she would be out of the service and having babies before you knew it. Not that you're allowed to say that these days, world gone mad, etc. As Douglas starts to straighten the bedclothes, he hears the rattle of the padlock on his bedroom door. So, an assassin rather than a burglar. Douglas had suspected as much. Sent by Martin Lomax, perhaps? The Americans, the Colombians? It seemed ridiculous, really, but Douglas would prefer to be shot by someone British. English, ideally, but beggars can't be choosers. Bolt cutters would get through the padlock within a minute, but not without making a noise, not without waking Poppy. He just needs Poppy to reach the intruder before the intruder reaches him. The bed is straightened and it now looks untouched, as if no one has slept there, as if the occupant is still out enjoying the night air. Douglas walks quietly over to the wardrobe, opens the doors and steps in. This will probably buy him only 10 or 15 seconds, but that might be enough. He closes the wardrobe doors behind him and stands in the dark. You always wonder in this job where it might end for you. Douglas might have died variously on a glacier in Norway, in a car boot on the Iran-Iraq border, or in a missile attack on an American base in Kinshasa. But perhaps it was all going to end in a tatty wardrobe, in his pyjamas, in an old people's home. Douglas was interested to find out. Scared too, certainly, but still interested. Of all the things that were to happen to you in life, death was one of the very biggest. Douglas hears the padlock give way. Surely Poppy heard that. Through the thin crack between the wardrobe doors, Douglas can make out a man walking into the room, gun raised and pointed at the bed. A pale light from a street lamp shines a single thin column through the curtains. He watches the man turn and look around him, having seen the bed is empty. Douglas is not breathing. Might never breathe again, he realizes, as the man turns to face the wardrobe. If someone is hiding, then this is the only conceivable place. And anyone who can silently open a door without a key and cut through an MI5 padlock within a minute will know that. The man takes two steps towards the wardrobe, gun still raised. White, Douglas thinks, maybe 40? So hard in this light. What was his name? Douglas wondered. It felt like that was information he should be allowed to know. Had they ever met, passed on a street like future lovers? Poppy wasn't coming. How had she not heard? Unless... Oh, of course. Of course! Perhaps Poppy had not been with Elizabeth this evening at all. Perhaps there had been a briefing. Orders handed down. We want this problem to go away. Just turn a blind eye. No one's to know. We'll send in one of our men. Douglas doesn't have any relatives, no kids to be asking questions. Poppy was junior enough to fall in line. She would be in her room now, cowering. When they found his body, would Elizabeth work out what had happened? A ridiculous thought. No one would find his body. A special ops group would be on hand to clear everything up. A military coroner would be waiting for him somewhere, all the paperwork done right, probably a suicide. Elizabeth would never get close enough to know any different. Elizabeth really was looking good, Douglas had to admit it. He would have loved another crack at her. Will she find his other letter? Of course she will. The man hooks an outstretched foot under one of the wardrobe doors and pulls them open. He smiles to himself as he sees Douglas standing there. The man looks English. The gun isn't service issue, but sometimes they employed freelancers. Worth a go? Says Douglas, his hands indicating the inside of the wardrobe. The man nods. Douglas waits for an epiphany, a sudden flash of clarity about his life, something to take with him on whatever journey he is about to embark upon. But there is nothing. Just a man with a gun and the label of his pajama top itching against the back of his neck. What a way to go. Where are the diamonds? Asks the man. an English accent. That brings Douglas some peace.
Afraid not, old boy, says Douglas. You're going to kill me anyway, and I'd rather someone else ended up with the diamonds.
I might not kill you, says the man. Douglas smiles and raises a dubious eyebrow at the man with the gun. The man with the gun nods in concession.
This will sound ridiculous, says Douglas, but let me solve one final mystery. I'd love to know who sent you.
The man shakes his head, and Douglas watches as he squeezes the trigger.
Chapter 16. Ibrahim can't sleep. The air around him is still. How many people have died in this hospital room? In this bed, in these sheets? How many final breaths still hung in this air? When his eyes close, he is back in the gutter. He feels the water, he hears the footsteps, he tastes the blood. The kick to the head now has a name. Ryan Baird. Where was Ryan Baird, he wonders. Where was Ibrahim's phone? Who bought stolen phones? Ibrahim had a Tetris app on his phone. There were 200 levels and he was on level 127 after playing for a considerable amount of time. All of that progress was lost. He looks at the red plastic tag on his wrist. The admin of death. There will be a drawer full of them somewhere. He has finally persuaded Ron to go home. Not that he isn't grateful for the company. Each night so far, Ron has stayed up with him and talked about West Ham and the problem with the Labour Party. And then, even later in the night, about his ex-wife and daughter. His son, Jason, and about leaving school at 14 and never knowing his dad. Anything, really, other than talk about what had happened. They watched Die Hard, but only the first one. No point watching the others, apparently. Ibrahim has never had a friend like Ron before, and Ron has never had a friend like Ibrahim before. Ron will fill his water jug when it needs filling, will get him frazzles from the machine, but will never make physical contact. No hand on his arm. Which is just fine by Ibrahim. It must be harder being a man these days, he thinks, being expected to hug. Ibrahim wants to go home, which he knows is a positive thing. It was positive to have a home in which he felt safe. To be surrounded by people who made him feel safer still. But he knows he will then never want to leave home again. Things would get back to normal. The brain is tremendously clever. One of the reasons Ibrahim likes it so much. Your foot was your foot and would remain your foot through thick and thin. But the brain changes. In form and in function. Ibrahim has respect for podiatrists, but really, looking at feet all day, the brain, that magnificent, dumb beast. He knows that alien chemicals are currently racing around his brain, protecting him in this moment of crisis. In time, these chemicals would fade, leaving nothing but a faint stain. When they say that time heals, that's what they mean. Like most things, when you really drill down into them, it is neuroscience, not poetry. Yes, time heals. Time heals. But what if time is the one thing Ibrahim doesn't have? I don't really believe in revenge. That's what he had said to the others when they talked about Ryan Baird. And in theory, he didn't. Revenge is not a straight line, it's a circle.
It's a grenade that goes off while you're still in the room, and you can't help but be caught in the blast.
Ibrahim had once had a client, Eric Mason, who had bought a used BMW from a dealer, an old school friend, in Gillingham. He soon discovered that the car had a faulty clutch. His friend at the dealership refused to accept liability, and Eric Mason, who, it should be said, had issues around emotional control and anger management, had replaced the clutch at his own expense and then driven the BMW straight through the window of the dealership in the dead of night. The car had then stalled, understandably, as it had just been driven through a large window, so Eric Mason was forced to abandon it and flee as alarms blared all around him. Unfortunately, he fell and impaled himself on a large shard of glass and was saved from bleeding to death only by the arrival of the police. Recovering in hospital, Eric Mason received a huge bouquet of flowers from the dealership. But, upon opening the card, discovered they had attached a court summons and a bill for £14,000. A spell of community service and bankruptcy followed. His fury grew. Eric's daughter and the son of the car dealer had also been friends at school. Eric forbade his daughter from ever talking to the boy again. And so, as winter follows summer, they had got married 2 years later, with Eric refusing to attend the wedding. Another year later, and Eric's grandson was born. Neither side would give ground, so Eric was unable to see his first grandchild, all because of a faulty clutch. It was at this point that Eric felt perhaps he should take responsibility for his own actions and decided to see a psychotherapist. 12 months later, on his final visit to Ibrahim, Eric Mason had brought in his daughter and his son-in-law to say thank you in person. He had also brought in his infant grandson, and they had posed together for a photograph, smiles all round. Ibrahim could feel himself drifting off and decided to stop fighting it. Whatever was waiting for him in his dreams, it was best to just face it unafraid. Accept the damage Ryan Baird had inflicted on him without thinking. Not the ribs, not the face. They would heal soon enough. But his freedom and his peace of mind snatched away for a phone. They say a man who desires revenge should dig two graves, and this is surely right. Then again, Ibrahim feels like his own grave has already been dug. So would there really be much harm in digging another for Ryan Baird? He wonders what his friends have in store for Ryan. Nothing physical, Ibrahim is sure of that. But freedom and peace of mind? Ryan might have a little surprise coming. The photograph of Ibrahim, Eric Mason, and Eric's grandson was in a special file Ibrahim kept at home. A file filled with a few mementos, not too many, all reminding Ibrahim why he loved his job. The file is the only one on Ibrahim's shelves that isn't kept in strict alphabetical order. Because sometimes you had to remember that life wasn't always arranged in alphabetical order, however much you would like it to be. Eric Mason, years later, discovered that nothing had been wrong with the clutch at all. He simply hadn't understood the electronic controls, and pressing a reset button for 5 seconds would have cleared it up. So you do have to be careful with revenge. But in all honesty, Ibrahim has spent most of his life being careful. And sometimes you had to do things differently if you wanted to grow as a human being. Ibrahim is certain that he could just press his own reset button for 5 seconds, and he could go on with forgiveness in his heart, go on doing the right thing, the correct thing, the boring thing.
the cruise control. But he still remembers Eric Mason, for all of his regrets, talking about the sheer ecstatic thrill of driving his car through that dealership window. And it is that image, not the kick to the head, not Ryan Baird's footsteps, and not the taste of blood, that Ibrahim is thinking about as he falls into his first peaceful sleep since the attack. Chapter 17. Joyce. It is 2 in the morning, but I want to write this all down while it is still fresh. My phone rang at midnight, and of course I thought Ibrahim had died. What else would you have thought in the circumstances? Nobody rings at midnight. He had looked well when we left him, but I've seen all sorts. I must have reached the phone within 2 rings. It was Elizabeth, and the first thing she said was, "It's not Ibrahim," so that was a relief. She can be sensitive when she tries. She said she knew it was midnight, but I was to throw on some clothes and meet her at 14 Ruskin Court as soon as I was able. I wondered if I needed to bring a flask, but I was told there was already a kettle and just to bring myself. It would have been quick to fill a flask, but you try telling Elizabeth that at midnight. I walked over to Ruskin, and it really is very pretty here in the dark. There are a few lamps lighting the paths, and you can hear the animals in the bushes. I could just imagine the foxes thinking, "What's this old woman up to?" And I was thinking the same. It was cold, but I have just bought a cardigan from Marks, which was perfect for the job. They delivered a few bits yesterday. I didn't mention it because I don't mention everything. For example, yesterday I was defrosting a lasagna and completely forgot about it. And that's the first you've heard of it. At the door I was buzzed upstairs, heart pounding, if I'm honest, not knowing what I was going to see. I pushed the door open and saw poor Poppy sitting in an armchair, shaking. Opposite her was Elizabeth in another armchair, but not shaking. That was the only furniture in the whole place. The flat was where Douglas was hiding. I worked that much out. "Put the kettle on, Joyce," Elizabeth said. "Poppy's had a shock." She sounded bossy, but I know she didn't mean it. She was just being professional. You wouldn't believe the kitchen, by the way. 2 mugs, 2 plates, 2 glasses, 2 bowls, some Frosties, some white mother's pride, then, in the fridge, some tofu and some almond milk. There was tea and coffee in one of the cupboards, and I poked my head back round, and Elizabeth and Poppy stopped their conversation, and I asked Poppy if she wanted milk and sugar, and she said could she have a cardamom and lychee infusion, and I nodded as if this was quite normal, which I understand it is these days, and ducked back into the kitchen. Goodness me, that was a long sentence to write. In a book, they would tell me to put a full stop in there somewhere. After infusion? I filled and boiled the kettle, anxious to get back to the living room and find out what was happening. If this was Douglas's flat, then where was he? I poured the water over the tea bag, which was made of grey cloth, but each to their own, and was just thinking about whether you're supposed to leave the bag in or take it out with herbal tea. If I left it in, then I could be out there quicker. But what if that wasn't the right thing to do? Joanna, like all daughters, would know. Anyway, that's when I heard the toilet flush. So, to hell with protocol, I left the bag in and went into the living room. I knew it was Douglas straight away. You could just tell. Very handsome, if I do say so myself. I could see in an instant why Elizabeth had married him and also why she had divorced him. I bet it was fun while it lasted, though. He was straight up to me and, oh, you must be Joyce, I've heard all about you. And really, I almost curtsied. And then I caught Elizabeth rolling her eyes. So I said, yes, and you must be Douglas. And he said, I imagine you've heard all about me too. And I said, not really, no. And I could see that Elizabeth liked that. I said, let me go into the bedroom and find another chair, but Elizabeth said to try Poppy's room as there was a dead body on Douglas's floor. Well, that was more like it. I got a hardback chair from Poppy's room and Elizabeth let Douglas tell me the story. He had been hiding in a wardrobe, which wasn't cowardly, but basic training, and some chap had a gun aimed at his head. He took some time over this bit of the story, discussing death and perspective and man's moral duty and a life well lived. I wished Ron had been there. He would have told him to wind his neck in, but it was me, so I listened politely. He was ready to meet his maker, that was the gist of it. But as the mystery man reached for the trigger, his head was blown clean off. And there was Poppy, like the cavalry, gun in hand, cool as you like. Cool, according to Douglas, but you could see she wasn't cool at all, still shaking, still quiet, both hands around her tea. She had said nothing about the bag still being in, so maybe it's okay. Though I don't think she was really in any state to, so it wasn't a proper test. I went and sat on the arm of Poppy's chair and put my arm around her, and she put her head on my shoulder and started to sob quietly. I don't think Douglas or Elizabeth had put their arm around her, and that's when I realised, of course, that was why Elizabeth had asked me there. Ron would have done just as well, but I bet Elizabeth isn't ready for Ron to meet Douglas yet. Douglas is so obvious. Ron would have a field day. I told Poppy she had been very brave, and Elizabeth told her she had been a terrific shot too, and Douglas said amen to that. But Poppy was having none of it, just silently weeping. Elizabeth did her best to be comforting, saying it was hard to kill someone, but sometimes that was the job. And then Poppy finally spoke and said, that's not a job I want. And I had some sympathy with that. It must be fun doing all the training, I suppose, and creeping around with no one knowing, but blowing a man's head off from 4 feet away probably doesn't suit everyone. It wouldn't suit me, and it doesn't suit Poppy. Actually, perhaps it would suit me. You never know until you try, do you? I never thought I would like dark chocolate, for example. I asked what was next and had the police been called, and Elizabeth said, well, after a fashion. I was hoping Chris and Donna might make an appearance, but apparently, in these cases, national security and so on, these things take a different route. So Elizabeth, Douglas and Poppy were waiting for some spies to come down from London and the case would be theirs. Which is a shame because Donna, in particular, would have enjoyed the whole scene. Elizabeth asked if I would like to see the body, and even though I really wanted to, I felt I should stay with my arm around Poppy, and so I said no, I was fine, but thank you. We only had to wait 20 minutes or so until the door buzzed and a woman and a man arrived. Sue and Lance, MI5, according to Elizabeth. Sue was in charge. They were both no nonsense. Sue reminded me an awful lot of Elizabeth. The manner. She must be nearly 60 and would have been pretty if she wasn't so angry. I know it doesn't matter if she's pretty or not, I'm just giving you an idea of her. Her hair was a lovely chestnut colour, dyed, but very nicely. I kept trying to make conversation, but I got nowhere. I could tell even Elizabeth was being respectful, so I followed her lead. They turned down my offer of a cup of tea, however. They both barged past me as I stood in the kitchen doorway. Not rude, as I say, they just had a job to do. Sue knew exactly what had gone on and told Douglas and Poppy to pack whatever they needed. She was surly with them both, especially Douglas. I ended up feeling quite sorry for him. Lance was dealing with the corpse, taking photos and so on. He looked like someone you would see in a DIY show on TV. Rugged and good with his hands, but never quite the star of the show. Just sawing some wood in the background. I asked if I could take a look at his camera, because I am thinking of getting one for Joanna for Christmas. He said he would show me when he was finished up, but in the end he didn't. Sue told Elizabeth they would need to speak to her in due course, and she said, well, naturally, but quiet as a mouse, not so much scared as knowing not to cause trouble. Sue looked at me at one point and said, is this Joyce? She told Elizabeth to ensure I told no one about the shooting and the body and so on. I said, Sue, you're safe with me. But she didn't even look in my direction, just at Elizabeth. Elizabeth reassured Sue I wouldn't tell a soul, and she nodded unconvinced. To be honest, I think she had bigger fish to fry. MI5 know who I am now, though, so that's one for the Christmas newsletter. Presently, there was another buzz at the door, and two men in overalls arrived with a stretcher. Paramedics wear green, of course, but these two were head to toe in black. They went into the bedroom and loaded the body onto the stretcher. Fortunately, I was able to get a quick peek before they zipped up the body bag, and yes, Poppy really had blown his head off. Or most of it, at least. It took me right back to my days in A&E. As Elizabeth and I were leading the stretcher down the corridor, a couple of doors opened, neighbours wondering about the noise, and Elizabeth was able to tell them not to worry. If you worried about every stretcher you saw at Cooper's Chase, you'd need one yourself soon enough. As we got outside into the open air, you could see a few lights on around the place and a few curtains opened, but, again, they were used to seeing ambulances at the dead of night. I said to Elizabeth that I was surprised it was just a normal ambulance, and she said it wasn't a normal ambulance. It just looked like one. As we went back in, Sue and Lance were leading Poppy and Douglas out. They had to be questioned, Elizabeth explained. Even in MI5, you can't just shoot someone without being asked a few questions about it. Elizabeth gave Poppy a hug, which was nice, and told her not to worry, she'd done everything right. Then I gave her a hug too and told her not to worry. I very nearly asked about the tea bag, but I will next time I see her instead. I gave Sue and Lance a friendship bracelet each. Sue looked like I'd just given her a parking ticket, but Lance said, thank you, I could use a bit of friendship. I didn't ask them for money. Douglas came out next with a book called Mega Structures of the Third Reich and a toothbrush. Sue told Elizabeth to secure the flat and make sure no one could gain entry. Elizabeth just nodded back to Sue and told her to take care of Poppy. Elizabeth then told me to go home and sleep, and so I went home, but I haven't slept. Listen to this. As soon as my door was shut, I took off my cardigan to hang over the back of the chair. As I was taking it off, I felt something in the pocket and I fished out a folded piece of paper which hadn't been there when I put it on. On the piece of paper was a message which simply said, "Ring my mum," followed by a phone number. Poppy must have slipped it into my pocket while we were hugging. So Poppy wants her mum. Poor love. I will ring her in the morning. I've put the television on. On BBC Two, they are showing normal programmes from the day, but with someone doing sign language in the corner. Isn't that clever? I was just thinking it was unfair to make deaf people stay up so late, but then realised they could tape them. What a nice thing. I'm watching a programme about the coast of Britain called Coast. Someone is digging up whelks. No thanks, to be honest, but the lady doing the sign language has a lovely top. I still haven't quite worked out how my Instagram works, which is very frustrating, as @greatjoy69 now has over 200 private messages. I wonder if anyone else is awake. Chapter 18. Ryan Baird is awake. He is currently playing Call of Duty online. He is spraying machine gun fire at full volume while his neighbours bang on the walls. Ryan made £150 today selling a couple of laptops, a debit card and a watch to Connie Johnson, who runs the whole of Fairhaven from the lock-up garages by the seafront. She trusts him, even gives him a package now and then to deliver to one of the estates. Drugs? Well, that's the thing to get into. Stealing phones is for kids. Ryan has been called stupid his whole life. But who's stupid now? He's got cash in his pocket. Connie Johnson clearly likes him. He's making more money than any 18-year-old he knows, probably making more money than his old teachers. The police had him in yesterday for nicking a phone and giving someone a shove, but they can't touch him. Because Ryan is smart. Too smart for the teachers, too smart for the cops, too smart for his neighbours now pressing on his door buzzer. Ryan Baird has got all the answers. Ryan lights one last spliff before bedtime, then curses as his lapse in concentration sees him shot by a sniper. Lucky video games aren't real life. Ryan reloads and starts again. He's invincible. Martin Lomax is awake too. A Saudi lawyer has a bee in his bonnet about a powerboat. Martin Lomax is on the phone trying to placate him. The long and short of it was he had received a powerboat as agreed compensation from the Cartagena cartel when the FDA had raided one of their Bolivian drugs labs, costing them all a great deal of money. The issue at hand was that the powerboat had arrived full of bullet holes, and the Saudi lawyer was of the opinion that this was aesthetically unpleasing and also a hazard to seaworthiness. Martin Lomax's other line rings, and he promises he will talk to the Cartagena cartel as soon as possible. MI5 are on the other line. Does he know an Andrew Hastings? He does. Does Andrew Hastings work for him? He does. No use lying, this is MI5 and they know already. Was Mr. Hastings working for him this evening? No, he was not. We regret to inform you that Mr. Hastings has been shot dead while trying to murder a member of the British Security Services. Condolences for your loss, but I wonder if you would have any comment on that. No. No comment. No comment at all. Would you know Mr. Hastings next of kin? No. Was he married? I think he was. Who to? No idea, never asked. Sorry to disturb you so late at night. No, not at all. Just doing your job. Martin Lomax puts down the phone. Hastings? Dead? Well, that was inconvenient. But he would deal with the powerboat first, and he still needed to order some trestle tables for the open garden. Poppy and Douglas are also awake. They are being interviewed in separate rooms inside a large country house near Godalming just to get the facts straight. Poppy has coffee in front of her and a union rep beside her. Lance James is asking her to talk through what happened. Douglas has no coffee and no union rep. It's just him and Sue Reardon. the way things should be done. Did he recognize the man who tried to kill him? Never seen him before. Would it surprise him to know the gunman worked for Martin Lomax? Well, yes and no. Yes and no how? Well, he must be working for someone, surely, and Martin Lomax has threatened him, so it's not outside the realms of possibility. But why would Martin Lomax want Douglas dead if he hadn't stolen the diamonds? Answer us that. No idea. Martin Lomax is playing some sort of game, that's for certain, and I'm stuck in the middle of it, nearly getting my head blown off. Take us through the break-in at Martin Lomax's house again, step by step. It is 3 in the morning by the time Poppy's union rep suggests it might be time to allow Poppy some sleep. As she walks down a long corridor, she can hear Sue Reardon still questioning Douglas Middlemiss. Chapter 19. Ron has skipped breakfast for this, and he's even more furious than usual. He has spent some time looking at the large bloodstain on the bedroom carpet, and he now inspects the bullet hole in the bedroom wall. "I've seen liberties taken," says Ron. "God knows they've all tried it on with me over the years, but this takes the wuss name. When did you find the body? 11:30? I was probably still up. I could have slipped on my shoes and been straight over. I swear, it's not often I'm speechless, but I'm speechless. I wish I could speak. I wish I had words." Ron has had all the fun he's going to have with the bullet hole and starts pacing. "Ron, don't pace over the bloodstains, please," says Elizabeth. "But no. Who gets the call? Joyce. Of course, Joyce. Everybody loves Joyce."
"I don't know about that," calls Joyce from the living room.
"Including you, Ron," says Elizabeth. "I haven't interrupted the two of you, so don't interrupt me," says Ron. "There's a dead body. A dead body. Geezer. Shot in the head. And what do? You ring Joyce. You don't ring Ron. Dear me. No, why would you ring Ron? He wouldn't want to see a corpse, would he? Old Ron, last thing he'd want to see. A bloodstain and a bullet hole will be enough for Ron. I've heard it all now."
"Are you finished?" says Elizabeth, looking into her bag.
"Take a guess, Elizabeth. Take a guess if I'm finished. Use those powers of deduction. No, I'm not finished. I would have loved it. Loved it."
"Come with me," says Elizabeth.
Elizabeth walks into the living room and takes the armchair opposite Joyce. Ron follows her through. Elizabeth takes a folder from her bag and places it on her lap. Ron has a speech to make.
"Here's my promise to you," he begins. "With Joyce as my witness, and it's not a promise friends should have to make, if I ever find someone shot, I will call you. I will call you because you're my mate. And that's what mates do. 2 in the morning, I don't care. I find a corpse, I pick up the phone. Elizabeth, there's a corpse on the landing, on the bowls lawn, doesn't matter where. Slip on a pair of shoes and come and take a look. I am absolutely fuming."
"Are you finished now, Ron?" asks Elizabeth.
"I've got something I need to talk to you about."
"Oh, yeah? Well, what if I've got something to talk to you about? About friendship?"
"As you wish," says Elizabeth.
"But we don't have an awful lot of time. We have a job to do."
"I've made you both a cup of tea," says Joyce. "Don't be angry, but it's herbal."
Ron hasn't finished, though.
"No apology. No, sorry, Ron, spur of the moment. I panicked. You think I see corpses every day of the week? Is that it? I've been in the hospital 3 nights. I get home and this is my reward. You see a dead body, Joyce sees a dead body, and I'm sat at home watching some documentary with Portillo on a train. That is insult to injury. I'm sorry, but it is. I thought we were friends."
Elizabeth sighs. "Ron, I like you. It is a huge surprise to me, but I do. I respect you too in a number of areas, but listen to me, dear. I was in an operational situation.
I had a man who had been seconds from death, a young girl who had just shot someone for the first time. I had a crime scene and I had MI5 arriving any time. So I felt I needed another pair of hands. I knew that both of you would want to see the corpse. That was a given. So I was left with a simple choice between a woman with 40 years of nursing experience and a man in a football top who would bang on about Michael Foot the moment MI5 arrived. Granted, 30-odd years ago, the job would still have gone to the man, but times change and I rang Joyce. Now, what can we do to calm you down?
I'm already calm, shouts Ron.
My mistake, says Elizabeth. Drink your tea, says Joyce. Ron stops for a moment.
What do you mean we've got a job to do?
That's better, says Elizabeth. Ron, I took a folder out of my bag midway through your rant.
It wasn't a rant, but let me ring the Queen and get you a medal for taking a folder out of a bag.
I did it quite slowly and deliberately, a buff-coloured folder, not the sort of thing I would normally carry in my bag. I thought you might notice.
Joyce noticed, I suppose, says Ron. Clever old Joyce.
Well, yes, she did. But the point is moot. Joyce hasn't seen this folder yet. It's just for me and you.
Joyce hasn't seen it? Asks Ron.
Not yet. She can see it eventually, says Elizabeth. But you and I have a job to do first.
I'm not sure about this, says Joyce.
Oh, don't you start, says Elizabeth. I'm placating Ron.
Ron nods.
OK. Sorry if I lost my rag there.
You didn't at all, dear. You voiced your frustrations, perfectly understandable.
So what's the job? What's in the file?
Don't think it's gone unnoticed that you stayed by Ibrahim's side when he needed you, says Elizabeth, and I think this is the reward you've earned.
Elizabeth holds out the file and Ron reaches over and takes it.
It has Ryan Baird's address, mobile telephone number, anything else you might need.
Ron flicks through it, nodding.
So we're going after him, he asks.
Straight away.
You're going after him, yes.
I'm going after him.
Joyce beams.
Wonderful.
Yes, I thought you'd like to, says Elizabeth.
I would like to, yeah, says Ron. You got a plan?
I do. I just need to see Bogdan about something first, then you'll get your instructions.
Ron nods. He taps the file against one of his big hands.
Poppy get you this, did she?
Elizabeth nods.
What's going to happen to her after blowing this geezer's head off?
She'll be fine, says Elizabeth. She did the right thing in the right way. They'll question her today, get everything straight, then probably back to work.
Will they let her see her mum, do you think? Asks Joyce.
Oh, goodness, no, says Elizabeth. Why would they let her see her mother?
I think I'd want to see my mum if I'd just shot someone, wouldn't you?
It's not kindergarten, Joyce.
You're always so sentimental, says Elizabeth.
Ron, still leafing through the file, looks up.
And your ex-husband, Dougie boy, what'll happen to him?
Much the same thing. They've had to move him out of here, of course. It's compromised.
So we're done with the old thing?
We're done with it. Our babysitting days are officially over.
We can still look for the diamonds, though.
Of course.
Good. You want to know what I think, by the way? Says Ron.
Not really, Ron, replies Elizabeth.
I think you could easily have made two phone calls last night. Could have had me and Joyce both here. But I think you didn't want me to meet your ex-husband.
Joyce nods as Elizabeth responds.
Well, I've always wished I'd never met him, so I like to extend the same courtesy to my friends.
Handsome, Joyce says.
Very, agrees Joyce.
Elizabeth shrugs.
What is it with men and handsome? Wouldn't you rather be kind and clever and funny and brave than handsome?
No, says Ron.
Can I ask you both something? Says Joyce.
Her friends both nod.
In your teas, I've left one bag in and one bag out. Could you try them both and let me know which you prefer?
Chapter 20. Something happened last night. Bogdan Yankovsky can just tell. He is on his way to the building site on top of the hill, but has popped into the shop at Cooper's Chase to buy some Lilt Zero and 20 Rothmans. A man he doesn't know has just got out of a van he doesn't recognise and headed over to Ruskin Court. Bogdan watches as the man lets himself into Ruskin Court using a key he shouldn't have. Something is up here. Bogdan approaches the van. As he peers through the passenger side window, he sees a newspaper, which is usual in a van, but then notes it is the Daily Telegraph, which is not. He looks at the side of the van, F. Walker Roofing, All Jobs Considered. From the corner of his eye, Bogdan sees Elizabeth, Ron and Joyce emerging from Ruskin Court. What are they all doing in Ruskin Court? Trouble, always trouble. And if there is trouble to be had, then Bogdan would like a piece of it. Elizabeth waves goodbye to Ron and Joyce, hurries over to him and, hooking her arm through his, leads him away from the van.
What's the van? Asks Bogdan.
How should I know? Says Elizabeth, who makes it her business to know everything. Good morning, though.
Good morning to you. Who are you seeing in Ruskin Court so early?
I borrowed a book from Marjorie Scholes, says Elizabeth.
What book? Asks Bogdan.
A Jeffrey Deaver, says Elizabeth. It's terrific.
Which one? Asks Bogdan.
They are now approaching Elizabeth's home in Larkin Court.
The most recent one. Thank you for walking me home. Will you be coming to see Stephen later?
Bogdan nods. We've got a big crane going up this morning, but nothing special after lunch, so I come down.
Bogdan is in charge of the new Hillcrest development, currently taking shape high up above them. He has had a series of rapid promotions due to the recent events, but is taking everything in his stride. Bogdan always takes everything in his stride.
Who was the guy who went into Ruskin Court wearing gloves?
No idea, darling. Drains? Drains would wear gloves, wouldn't they?
He walked in 30 seconds before you walked out, and you walked out 10 seconds after I start to look at the van.
I think you're being a little paranoid, Bogdan. Are you getting enough sleep?
I get 8 hours and 20 minutes every night, says Bogdan. You promise me something, though?
If I can, of course. If I can't, then no.
You tell me why you're lying, eventually. About the van and the man? And I just saw Marjorie Scholes in the shop. So, how did you get into Ruskin? You tell me sooner or later?
Oh, Bogdan, we all have our secrets. I'll see you later, I hope.
Bogdan nods and Elizabeth goes inside. Bogdan retraces his steps, but the van has gone. He walks up the hill, thinking about men with gloves and keys they shouldn't have. The Hillcrest development is running according to plan, of course it is. He is making plenty of money, too. Half goes into the building society and half goes into Bitcoin. He is not tempted to buy a house because buying a house meant you were staying and you could never really predict if you were staying, could you? Bogdan spends the morning checking the works, supervising the installation of the crane, and smoking his Rothmans.
He then makes his way back down the hill to play chess with Elizabeth's husband, Stephen. He passes the graveyard where the nuns are buried. What do they make of the steam hammers sinking foundation posts further up the hill? Bogdan finds the noise soothing and he hopes they do too. No one wants silence for eternity. He passes Bernard's bench. It was strange not to see the old man there keeping guard. People here came and went, they came and went. Knowing they were here to live out their days made them vital. They moved slowly, but their time ran fast. Bogdan liked to be among them. They will die, but so will we all. We are all gone in the blink of an eye, and there is nothing to do but live while you're waiting. Cause trouble, play chess, whatever suits you. He and Stephen try to play at least 3 times a week. It gives Elizabeth a bit of time off to go shopping, visit friends, solve murders. Stephen forgets most people's names now, but he has never forgotten Bogdan's. Inside Elizabeth's flat, the game is 12 moves old, and Bogdan has Stephen in something of a bind. Bogdan is not counting his chickens, of course, he must never do that with Stephen, but he is happy with his position. He doesn't see that Stephen has many options for his next move. That next move may take a while, as Stephen has fallen asleep. It is happening more and more often these days as he shuts down further and further still. But so long as Stephen is here, Bogdan will play chess with him. And whenever Stephen's eyes pop back open, Bogdan knows he will still be in for a brutal game. Exactly the way he likes it. Stephen has forgotten many things, but he hasn't forgotten how to win a game of chess. He also hasn't forgotten Bogdan's big secret, the part he played in the recent murders, and is happy to bring it up whenever a game is particularly tight. Bogdan has no fear, though. He trusts Stephen absolutely. And who would Stephen tell anyway? Only Elizabeth, and Bogdan trusts Elizabeth completely too. And, speak of the devil, Bogdan hears the key in the door and sees Elizabeth walk in. She is carrying a large sports holdall, which is unusual. "Hello, dear," says Elizabeth. "Is he asleep?" "Maybe. I think he's faking it, though. He knows I've got him beaten." "Let me make you both a cup of tea. Could I ask you a favour, Bogdan?"
"Who was the man with the gloves?" asks Bogdan.